And we'll just go down the order here. Senate Bill 43, we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 43.
Senate Bill 43 excludes certain functions performed by title companies from definition of unlawful practice of law, authorizes title companies to draft certain real estate transaction documents while placing tangible limitations on scope of authority granted. As a subsequent judiciary, no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and there are amendments.
Okay, very good. George Raymer. Did I pronounce that right?
Raymer.
Yes. Okay. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the record. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is George Raymer, and I'm General Counsel of the Oregon State Bar, and I'm here to, in support of Senate Bill 43. The principal purpose of Senate Bill 43 is to clarify when and under what circumstances title and escrow agents may prepare legal documents without being deemed to be engaging in the unlawful practice of law. There's a famous Oregon Supreme Court case that goes back about 40 years that basically determined when non-lawyers crossed the line in this area between what they could do as a business activity and what would constitute the practice of law. So over 40 years of time, obviously there have been lots of improvements, and business has progressed to the point where there are many legal documents that are prepared on a daily basis that really don't risk much harm to the general public in their preparation by non-lawyers. So the bar has been working with a variety of groups, the title and escrow companies, members of the bar's unlawful practice of law committee. And since the introduction of the bill, there have been some meetings that have tried to improve upon the prior product, the original bill. And essentially, the amendments would require that the parties to the transaction have a disclosure to make sure that they understood that if they wanted to go to a lawyer to have the documents that the title and escrow folks prepared, that they would have that opportunity. And it elaborates that in certain circumstances, the title and escrow companies have to provide actually copies of the documents, I think no less than 3 business days before the transaction would close, so that people would have that opportunity to consult with counsel. So I think you have the Dash amendments dealing with that particular clarification. There's also a separate a proposed amendment that deals what is called the multi-jurisdictional practice of law, and that would be where lawyers come from other states to perhaps engage in isolated business transactions on behalf of clients, let's say from Washington. Washington lawyer with Washington clients come to Oregon to engage in, let's say, a business closing or something of that sort with a Oregon lawyer and an Oregon client. But that wouldn't be deemed to be the unlawful practice of law so long as they complied with rules that the bar and the Supreme Court would adopt in this area. That Dash amendment basically would just give the bar and the court that authority to establish rules to deal with the multi-jurisdictional practice of law.
Okay, that that amendment hasn't been printed, is that right? Or in front of us, we have the Dash. What do we have?
Dash one.
We have the Dash ones.
Yeah. Well, I have kind of a working copy. I think that has been approved by legislative council, but I don't know if it received, you know, official printing yet.
Is that the same? We just have the only one around.
We have the Supreme Court.
Okay, but is there another amendment that we need to be considering at this time?
Or just well, the one I'm working off of is dated February 8th, I believe.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The clarification. The original part of your testimony, when you're talking about amendments, are you talking about the bill as printed, those amendments?
There are subsequent amendments that I believe the committee has been provided.
Mr. Chair, yes. Question. We've got I at least have a Dash 1 amendment that is, which is the amendment I think you spoke to dealing with the Supreme Court issue about allowing out-of-state counsel to temporarily come into the state. But so you think there's another amendment?
Yeah, I've got the, well, it's a working draft. I don't know if it's gotten to the committee in official form yet.
We don't have that. That's what's important.
Well, I'm sorry about that. I thought that they were going to be available by today through Legislative Council's office. I don't have, I can certainly show you what I have
in hand. I think we have a proposed thing. Is this... that's the Supreme Court. Okay. We don't have that, so we'll just have to get that to the run it through the process.
All right. Well, that's all I have.
We have this. Any questions on this amendment? We have one more amendment coming.
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Well, that'll be good. Okay. So we'll just. Wait for that to come forward and then run everything at the same time. How's that sound?
Great. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Okay, well, we will close public hearing on Senate Bill 43. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 63. Mr. Dotson.
Senate Bill 63 requires Workers' Compensation Board assign multiple employer cases to administrative law judge. Judge authorized to manage investigation discovery processes. Cases to be set only after medical evidence fully developed and employers and insurance with no exposure not required to participate in trial. No revenue impact, no fiscal statements have been issued.
All right, very good. Well, welcome, gentlemen. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chris Moore. I'm an attorney from Eugene representing injured workers.
And I'm Steve Cotton. I'm an attorney representing employers here in Salem.
Who wants to start here? What are we?
We've been here once before, yeah. And we went away to amend some language. That language has been amended. We do not have the final draft of it from Legislative Council, and that language was primarily to deal with a statutory reference that we felt, or that the Workers' Compensation Board felt might limit their ability to implement the act. That has been changed. And I think meets with everyone's satisfaction. We were also sent away to present this bill to Management Labor Advisory Committee. We have been there twice, most recently on Friday. At the Friday meeting, we were presented with two very reasonable concerns by management members, and they asked for some changes, which we are in the process of getting from Legislative Council. And just to be real clear about what those changes are, first concern was whether the administrative law judge would be obligated to join employers or insurers in these hearings rather than the claimant's attorney, and everyone agreed we did not want the administrative law judge being an advocate for either side. We want them to be a neutral and to decide the case, not to be responsible for joining people. We feel that we've dealt with that problem. That's a fairly simple one to deal with. The other problem is one that I guess I'd like Mr. Cotton to speak to, because as a claimant's lawyer, I never see this issue. And
insurers have certain obligations to meet, or they are subject to a civil penalty through the Department of Consumer and Business Services. One of those is the timeliness of the denials that are made. There was some concern expressed at MLAC that there is the possibility, because we are trying to economize on resources by, for instance, number of times the claimant is interviewed, that there may be a possibility that it would be more convenient to get that interview done, but the denial time may slip, and the employers were really concerned that they were going to be penalized for something when they were trying to cooperate with making the system more efficient. We're trying to come up with some language now that will take care of that, and we'll have it available. If I may make one additional comment, some of the language that's in front of you that we talked about last time, there were two references to statutes, 307 and 308, and we came up with some language that was proposed. And there's a new language now that refers to one or more potentially responsible employer or insurer. And I just wanted to make sure that we had on the record that we mean absolutely all possible permutations of that, insurers, employers. I think we talked about that last time. But because of the restriction of certain styles that are required in statutes, we just wanted to make sure it covers the whole gamut.
And I agree with those comments.
Thanks. Anything else? I sure. Once we're still waiting for some, any questions from the committee?
Should we not want to amend?
Everybody has time to read these things, huh? Finding all problems. Well, thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing and then get these amendments and get this thing moving.
Thank you.
Close public hearing on Senate Bill 63. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 233. Mr. Johnson.
Senate Bill 233 allows unemployment insurers to terminate liability with 30-day termination notices to employers. Authorizes employment director to specify surety permitted to demonstrate ability to meet financial obligations. Eliminates claim closure penalty and requirement for Oregon Attorney General to review claim and establishes identical appeal periods for workers and employers. No revenue impact, fiscal statement issued.
Hey, John. How are you doing today?
Very well, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself.
I'm John Schiltz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is a part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And as you may recall, we did present testimony in support of this bill previously on February 10th, and I appear today to again request the committee's support for Senate Bill 233, this time as amended by the Dash 1 Amendment. Senate Bill 233 in total covers three major areas for workers' compensation law. Essentially, the areas that we've talked about before with you were coverage, non-compliant employer claims, and self-insurance security. The Dash 1 Amendment pertains to the self-insurance security issue. Now, self-insured employers must make a deposit with the director of the Department of Consumer Business Services security to pay injured worker benefits in the event that they have a default or a bankruptcy. Since the courts have ruled that money and government securities cannot be protected in a bankruptcy court proceeding, this bill eliminates the mandate that is in the current statute for the director to accept money or government securities as the form of security. Senate Bill 233 provides that the director would have the authority to specify the acceptable form of security by rule. Some self-insured employers currently have used time deposits and various other financial instruments to meet their security obligation, and were concerned that the original language of the bill would require that they would have to immediately find some alternative form of security. So the Dash 1 Amendment clarifies that the changes to ORS 407-2, which is in Section 2 of the bill on page 3, lines 12 through 14, would only apply to security deposits that are established on or after the effective date of the bill. Now, this would allow self-insured employers to maintain their existing forms of security until the maturity dates of their financial instruments, which at that time they would need to find a replacement security in a form that would be acceptable under the administrative rule. New self-insured employers or current self-insured employers who are required to increase their security deposits would need to obtain that new or additional security in the form allowed by the rule. Again, those are the main effects of the bill, and I think that it addresses the concern that was expressed by the self-insured employers that's going to allow the self-insured employers who have existing forms of security that would not be permitted under the new statute to maintain those until they reach their maturity dates. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schultz, are you guys trying to keep this out of the hands of a bankruptcy trustee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we're trying to maintain control over these securities ourselves versus having the bankruptcy trustee maintain control. And the trustee may choose to use that money to pay the injured workers' claims, but that would be their choice, not ours.
Yeah, follow-up question, because I'm confused about how it is that you think the bankruptcy trustee can't access this alternative fund or alternative deposit. So how is it that you're maintaining control and the trustee can't get to it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, the advice that we've received from the Department of Justice is that there are forms of security currently that we would be able to maintain control over. Specifically, those would be surety bonds, and another form that we are looking at are letters of credit.
Okay, and so you want to change the current form of security to these that the trustee can't get at by just going and grabbing them, but the trustee could take advantage of them and distribute them to the workers if you allowed the trustee to do that. Is that the control that you want?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, what we are trying to do is maintain control of this ourselves to ensure that the goal is to ensure the injured worker gets their benefit money directly from this form of security. Typically, what that would mean is that we would maintain that control ourselves.
Well, I think that's the goal of the bankruptcy court also, but sometimes the rules conflict about who gets what. It becomes a free-for-all. So, okay, that answers my questions. Thank you.
Do we have a Dashboard amendment?
I don't.
We have a testimony about Dashboard.
I haven't. It
seems that Dennis has one.
No.
You don't?
One of those days.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for that. I was under the impression that that had been forwarded. The Dash 1 amendment itself reads, Section 15, the amendments to ORS 656-407 by Section 2 of this 2003 Act apply to securities provided on or after the effective date of this 2003 Act. And I do have a copy with me, if that would be a problem.
We have one copy here, and we'll get some more for the rest.
Again, I apologize for that.
That's no problem. It's Monday on Wednesday, what it appears to be today. Any other questions here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Okay. I don't have any other people lined up to testify. Is anybody interested in this bill and wants to testify? If not, we will recess the public hearing until we get back with the copies, and then we'll open up a public hearing on 341. Mr. Johnson.
Senate Bill 341 excludes employment listing services from definition of employment agency, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2003. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay. This is sponsored by Senator Biden.
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair, and the proponent of the bill is not in the room. I don't know where he went. He was sitting there a second ago, and now he's not
Mr.
there.
Mr. Day, huh?
Yeah. So.
Well, there's Commissioner Dan Gardner's here. You want to go up and testify, sir?
Certainly.
I see your name here. I got you up here sooner. Very good, sir. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the Bureau has been working with Senator Beyer's office on this particular piece of legislation. As it happens today, we don't allow a private employment agency to, just for the listing of a job, to charge a fee under current law for listing of those services. This particular bill there are some amendments to it that we've seen, but I would suggest a slightly different approach in the bill. in that we look at the terms of the contract terms and conditions, and that they be established between the employment listing services and the client, and that the provisions for a written fee schedule and notice of those change requirements be included in the bill, and also documentation of job information obtained to see that these employment agencies are actually listing real jobs and not, for instance, just taking the Sunday Oregonian and listing on a website jobs that are already available other places as well, so that they're not, you know, charging a fee for that, and also include periodical updates and verification of the information that those jobs really do exist for those fees. And also would suggest in the inclusion of the bill also a loss of entitlement and penalties for violation of the previous specifications, which is already currently allowed under employment listings. But those are just a few suggestions of potential changes for the legislation. I think it can be very well worked out, Mr. Chair, and I think the Bureau could find, with changes like that, something we could definitely support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for your record, my name is Ross Day. I'm the Director of Legal Affairs at Oregonians Action, but I'm not here in that capacity today. I'm here as a former attorney in private practice. I represent a business named Permanent Employment. What they are, what they're recognized in 14 other states, is an employment listing service. And what they do, effectively, is they publish a list, basically want ads, and they sell subscriptions to the list to people who are presumably looking for employment, either looking for new employment or other employment. The problem is we've had about a two-year-long litigation with Boley over whether or not my clients were employment agencies. We, of course, said they weren't. Boley's position was that we are. And the problem with being labeled as an employment agency is you're not allowed to charge fees up front for your service. And in our business model, if we're not able to charge fees up front, it basically makes it impossible to do business. Like I said, we are permitted to operate in at least 14 other states, or we operate in 14 other states, including Washington, where we are allowed to charge a fee up front for the service and for the subscription service. We actually weren't located in Oregon either. We were located out of Vancouver, but we were advertising in the Oregonian. That being said, we went through the whole litigation process that us lawyers love, and we got a decision that was adverse to our clients. That's technical lawyer talk for we lost. And so I promised my clients that I'd see if we can't work out some sort of arrangement that would allow them to operate in Oregon and help put people back to work. I don't have any problem with the suggestions that the commissioner is making with regards to fixing the bill, the amendments, taking the requirement that the commissioner approve the fee that we charge, but instead requiring it go into the contract. That's absolutely not a problem. One of the things, just to give you by way of a little background on the employment agency statutes, the intent behind the statutes, they were enacted in 1947, I believe, was for consumer protection. What was happening is people were coming back from the war and being told, hey, for $10 I can get you a job, and you pay them $10, and then they'd run off and never see them again. And so that's why we have the restrictions on paying fees up front and the contracts and so on and so forth. It's taken several changes over the years, but that philosophy, that policy, has always stayed true in private employment agency statutes. By exempting the employment listing services out of private employment agencies, as the bill itself would do, we don't have any of those protections for the consumer in the statute. Basically, employment listing services would be allowed to do what they do, as I understand, down in California, where you'll walk down the street and you'll see a telephone pole that'll say, government jobs guaranteed government jobs, call here $50, and so you pay them $50, and then you say, well, how do I get my government job? And they say, go enlist in the Army. And there's no prohibition on that. We're trying to avoid that. Permanent employment is not, we want to make sure that gives, that consumers, that people, frankly, who are most likely the most vulnerable, those without work, have the most protection. And so what we would like, I have no problem, absolutely think we can work something out. It's not a problem at all, and we'll do that. We'll get some amendments to you.
No.
Oh, I did have one other thing. I'm sorry. I apologize. I do want to make it clear on the record. We do permanent employment, although I don't represent them, it is not the intention of this bill to fix their retro or their past problems. This is prospective only. It's not intended to go retroactively. And I want to make that clear for the record.
Thank you. Chair Nelson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christine Hammond. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and it's the Wage and Hour Division that enforces the private employment agency laws. I'm just here with Commissioner Gardner in case there are any questions regarding the regulations or our enforcement of the law.
Pretty much, Mr. Chair. Actually, Mr. Chair, the only thing I'd like to add is that, you know, we are perfectly in agreement that it is a new technological age, and these types of employment agencies have not been around before, and it's time to make a change in that part of the law, but also would like to see that the consumer protection portions are there as well to make sure that, as in his example, we don't charge someone $50 for telling them to go enlist in the military service. So.
Oh, very good. So you guys are going to work out on some amendments and get that. Okay, any questions?
No, I just want to make a comment. Mr. Chair, I appreciate the comment by Mr. Day about this being a prospective bill. I get a little bit irritated when people lose in court and come here asking for retroactive fixes on their problems. Thank you.
Very good. Well, thank you. I will close the public hearing on 341, and we'll go back to Senate Bill, we recessed the public hearing on that. We'll reopen it again on Senate Bill 233. And the committee now has, I hope, the dash ones.
Mr. Chair, I had a question.
Okay. What is the question?
The question is that in reviewing my notes from February 10th, when we last had this bill up for hearing, I made a notation at the bottom of my notes that Senator Beyer had an amendment he wanted drafted to conform with Senate Bill 234. And I don't know that this dash one amendment addresses Senator Beyer's concern or if he even remembers what that was about.
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, I would guess, because I do not remember, but you showed me your notes, I must have just asked if we needed a conforming amendment because we had already passed Senate Bill 234 and the two bills may be in conflict with one another. I don't know if that was looked into or not.
Yeah, Dennis indicated he talked with legislative counsel that they were not in conflict. So
okay.
We don't need a conforming.
Great. My notes didn't lie then.
They didn't. Very good.
All right. Thank you. That was my only question.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Any more issues on Senate Bill or on the amendments in Senate Bill 233? We'll go to a work session here, and I'll close the public hearing and open up a work session on Senate Bill 233. Address any issues or questions on the dash one amendments. Chair would move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 233. Any discussion, objections? So ordered. And Chair would move Senate Bill 233 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Comments?
Just one. As someone who's worked in bankruptcy court for about 20 years now, I appreciate that we're trying to keep this money with the workers where it belongs instead of the hands of the trustees. Trustees do their job to bring money into the estate, but sometimes it's not a good result. So I like this bill and I like what it's doing.
Anybody got any further comment? Motion is to move to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? So ordered. Anybody have a particular desire to carry that? Yes?
I will.
Senator Walker. We'll do that. And we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 406. Mr. Dotz.
Senate Bill 406 prohibits retaliating or discriminating against individual because individual inquired about family leave, submitted a request for family leave, or invoked any provision of family leave law. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
All right, very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and it's a pleasure to be here the second time today before you on Senate Bill 406. I think in my written testimony, it outlines that in 1987 we passed in the state of Oregon one of the best family leave laws and the first in the nation family leave law to give, you know, parents of newborns and newly adopted children the ability to spend time at home with their child. Although at the time that it was drafted, it appears that there was just a minor glitch put into it, if you will. It doesn't specifically state within the legislation that it's unlawful to discriminate or retaliate against anyone inquiring with their employer for a request to take family leave or to take or have that protection. I don't believe anyone wishes to retaliate for someone for making that request. It does say it in another portion of the Family Medical Leave Act. However, in this portion, it does not, and I believe that this technical error should be corrected, and it is corrected with this particular bill.
Oh, Annette Talbot, Deputy Commissioner for the record of the Bureau of Labor. Just here to answer questions. I think Commissioner explained it. We have somewhat of a ludicrous result in the law if you really interpret it literally, and that would be you could actually take leave. You could ask Woolley about taking leave. You could testify in front of a committee about taking leave, and you would all be protected in terms of retaliation. But if you just inquire of your employer, arguably the law doesn't cover that. So it seems an odd way that really just inadvertently comes out in drafting. I think the intent of the law was clear that inquiring about leave would certainly be just as protected as any of actually taking leave. So it's just subject to that interpretation, and we'd like to clarify it.
Okay, good. I guess some questions. How does this thing actually work? I mean, do you if a complaint comes in, what's the process then?
If a complaint comes into the Bureau as far as retaliation, then there it goes through our process of first going through intake to see if there is cause to the claim or not, and then it goes to an investigator to investigate. And our goal, of course, is always to make sure that the employer comes into compliance before anything further happens. But I guess it would depend upon the nature of the type of retaliation that was taken, where it would go from that further process. It could go all the way to an administrative law judge hearing and see that, you know, remedy is taken at that point.
And the investigators are continually tracked. Outcome of the cause. I mean, is there an order or something that comes out?
Mr. Chair, that it would be like any other civil rights investigation where the employer gets notice of a complaint filed, they get an opportunity to put information in the record, and then the Bureau's obligation is to see whether there's substantial evidence, like any administrative hearing, that there's actually been a violation of the law. So none of that would change with this. It would all be the same process.
Who has the burden to prove that there's, you have administrative law?
In the administrative law hearing, it's really up for the Bureau to decide whether there's substantial evidence. Often what happens is the employee puts forth an allegation that something was done incorrectly under the law. The employer gives a response, and then the Bureau's obligation is to see if the employer's response may be a pretext and for really not having done the incorrect thing. So at the end of that, we all look at whether the evidence is what a reasonable person would use to find that there had been a violation, and it's kind of a shorthand for what substantial evidence.
The agency really has the burden of proof.
The agency has to be able to say there is enough evidence in this record based on the investigation to support a finding of a violation, and it can go all the way for the commissioner to sign an order.
Okay. All right. questions?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm curious. Are you bringing this bill because someone had a complaint of retaliation for an inquiry, or you were just reviewing the records and the laws?
We were basically just reviewing, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we were basically just reviewing the record and wanted to make sure that this clarifying language was in the statute.
Okay. Thank you.
As investigators, do they have like a checklist or some sort of thing they go through before you find out whether or not it's, you have a cause of action?
Usually that happens, Mr. Chair, at the point of intake. When you intake the claim, they initially see if there is all the elements of a claim to it, and then it will go to an investigator if there is cause found for it. If there's no cause, it's immediately dismissed from the beginning.
Is there any change to any of that, those procedures?
Not with this bill,
no,
Mr. Chair.
None.
Okay. Senator Mitchell.
Yes, I had a question. By the way, I understand the top line in the back page of your testimony, Commissioner, that this right would not extend to the person asking her employer about leave, but I assume that means guys, too, right? I mean,
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, absolutely. Yeah. It would be a gender-neutral reference.
I was curious to kind of follow what Senator Walker said. Just since the Family Leave Act was enacted in 95, do you have any statistical information about, you know, how many complaints have been filed? I just kind of wonder, you know, how the conforming rules have been, and if there's been any problem, or whether I know you answered Senator Walker's question that, you know, you found this hole and you wanted to plug it, but has there been substantial issues here?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, having been on the job nine weeks, I don't have statistical data on how many complaints there were. I'm only aware of one case that has come to the point of final order, which I signed a few weeks ago. It was a case in which a hotel maid was. After she had taken family medical leave and had informed the employer that she was ready to go back to work, did not get the hours back that she had beforehand, and there was one final order filed on that one during my tenure so far as Labor Commissioner, but that's the only one I'm aware of.
Thank you very much. We have Marcia Kelly and Lisa Trussell.
I will. I'm Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition. Our members include the American Association of University Women, the Oregon Women's Political Caucus, Delta Kappa Gamma, the Salem YWCA, the Older Women's League of Oregon, Oregon Now, and I think that's it. And individual members. We're here in support of the slight changes to the law to make it very clear what can happen with family leave for either males or females, because we're very much in support of allowing families to have the time that they need from employment with adequate notification to their employers so that families can be strengthened. And we just wanted to be in support of that. I do know that there was at least one other case in Oregon because I was trying to look for some statistics and preparing for today. And coincidentally, there was a story on the NPR in the last 10 days that talked about a woman who started a company after she had been fired because she had been spending time at the hospital with her daughter who'd had a ruptured appendix and had had time away from work, and her employer fired her. So, coincidentally, it does happen.
Any questions? Lisa?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and we're here today in opposition to Senate Bill 406. We believe that the current law and administrative rules and bully policy addresses the issue satisfactorily.
Do you have any issues with the way the investigations go and how employers are represented in these issues?
Mr. Chair, we have we've heard complaints, and I haven't been able to document, but we are hearing that there is concern that there's a the department would be taking a quote different direction when it came to findings, but at this time I don't have anything to offer as to substantiate that.
Any questions?
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, hearsay isn't really appropriate testimony, Ms. Russell, but you're entitled to your opinion. I'd like to ask you a question, though, when you say that the Oregon administrative rules address this issue satisfactorily. Could you explain how you believe that to be true?
Well, even presented in Commissioner, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker and Commissioner Gardner's statement, they indicate in here that they have policies that that they're interpreting it this way already. I didn't bring those in, but it's our belief and our membership's belief that the rules they currently have adequately address this.
But you don't, you're not opposed to the rules in place, so it seems logical to assume you wouldn't be opposed to having it in statute either, would you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I think that there's probably a number of areas related to the family leave law that any particular group might want to look at implementing some change in. And at this time, as a, we've had five special sessions where much testimony was received about regulatory burdens, and at this time, we just don't think this is something that's necessary in Oregon right now for Oregon employers.
Valerie, that last comment confused me, if I might, Mr. Chair. You said this is not necessary for Oregon employers, yet if it's already being done in an administrative rule, I don't understand.
If the Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we believe that the current law and the policies and practices and the administrative procedures that currently govern BOLI adequately address this situation.
Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you.
The statute, the proposed amendment in subsection 2, or not section, the parentheses 2, is an unlawful employment practice by employer to retaliate. That's really basically the change. That's causing me concern.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Senator?
Under 2, in parentheses, it is an unlawful employment practice for an employer to retaliate or in any way discriminate against an individual. Is this thing that's causing problems? Is this broadening the whatever you think is an unlawful employment practice? Or?
Yes, Mr. Chair. When you deal with expansions of what is unlawful employment practices, it frequently gets employers concerned. And having not been demonstrated that there's been a situation that we haven't addressed, we're not supportive of changing something right now when there doesn't seem to be a need for it when they're already applying the law in that manner.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
I think what, since there is some issues here that the
Mr. Chair,
yes. Sure, yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could just clarify a couple of things. First of all, this is not an expansion of current law. It really is just codifying into law what our current administrative rules already are. But as we all know, I was a former legislator, as you as legislators know, that we are only allowed to have administrative rules up to the extent of the statutory authority. This was the intent from talking to those who were there drafting the original Medical Leave Act, was not to be able to retaliate simply for applying for it, and it does simply mirror what federal law says on Federal Family Leave Act. This is just extending it to Oregon Family Medical Leave Act. It really isn't an expansion of the law, but simply codifying what we currently have in rule.
There seems to be some some concerns. I'd like the parties to sit down and talk to each other and see what's going on and make sure we get this everything in reasonable shape. If we're in that much of a hurry in this particular time, but we'll get everybody together and see if we can move this forward.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I would just ask, and that's, you know, that's certainly a good directive. I would just ask, though, that if anybody has a problem with it that can be defined, that they should define what that problem is and offer the corrective solution rather than I just don't like it. I'd like to know what it is and what it is, what the word changes or language changes that, you know, that make the comfort zone, I think, is appropriate, but not just because I don't like it.
Okay. Sounds good. Anything else? Any other comments?
No, I'm just prepared to move the bill, so.
Okay, we will
get ready.
Close the public hearing and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 546. And Mr. Dotson.
Senate Bill 546 requires public contracting agency to subtract 5% bid evaluation preference from bid of resident bidder in determining lowest responsible bidder. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact.
Oh. Okay, well, I see this is a bill sponsored by Senator Metzger. Kirkland, you wish to...
Well, I think Mr. Gladkin will testify just for the purposes of opening the conversation, though, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that attempts to address some of the issues that I think a lot of the legislative assembly have had about, making sure that we retain Oregon businesses and jobs. And, there's been discussions about agriculture. There's been discussions about license plate manufacturers. And this is an attempt to do that, and I think Mr. Gladkin can speak more specifically to that.
Very good. Well, we have Diane Lancaster, Annette Glad, and Tim Nisbet. Boy, I want you all come up. And Jessica, too. Jessica, why don't you get up here close at hand?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just wanted to ask Senator Metzger, this bill is a result of the license plate issue.
That's one of the issues
of
we're
the
talking
issues.
About losing things because of.
Oh. Okay, I dealt with that in the interim, and I have a file on that because I think you and I are going to have a difference of opinion on it, so I'm going to run upstairs and see if I can find it. I'll be back.
Okay. Now we're now in subcommittee status. So we'll just proceed. Let's see. Diane, do you want to start off?
I certainly can. Thank you, Senator Nelson. For the record, I'm Diane Lancaster. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer for the Department of Administrative Services. Our position on this bill is neutral. We have a statutory obligation to collect and maintain information around the country on what other states and our own establish as preferences, and that report is in your packet there at the end. We have you'll see there's a cover sheet that shows the states of the union, and then there are details about every single state in the union, what they have reported to us. We took that information, and for the purposes of this bill, we evaluated it and came up with some information that we thought might be of interest and perhaps of help to this committee. And, of course, we can take back any other questions that you would have of us. We looked to see what the impact of this bill might be, and what we found, of course, is that it depends. Preferences are literally all over the map, and there are particularly two situations that you'd want to look at. One is where another state has an in-state preference law, and in those situations that where the non-resident bidder coming into the state of Oregon to bid comes from a state with a preference statute, this change would effectively increase the amount of preference that the Oregon bidder would gain by 5%. And I've got an example in the testimony here. This gets kind of complicated, but I've tried to make it as simple as I can. For example, Alaska, state of Alaska has a 5% in-state preference for vendors who qualify as Alaska bidders. Our current reciprocal preference law requires, that we would add an equal 5% increase to the Alaskan vendors' bid if they came to this state. If Senate Bill 546 were enacted, it would actually increase that preference to an additional 5%. So it's a two-part kind of formula. And so in that example, for the Alaskan vendor coming to the state of Oregon, an Oregon bidder would actually gain a 10% price advantage given that math. So you can see that it will depend on each state and how they set up their own in-state preferences. Another major example of how this bill would act in our evaluations would be where the other state has a reciprocal preference law. As I mentioned, we have currently a reciprocal preference law that says if you come into our state and your state disadvantages our bidders, we're going to do likewise to you. And there are 33 states in the union that have this this sort of statute, and those are listed in the packet. The downside of that, I suppose, is that it could potentially set up a disadvantage for Oregon vendors who wish to do business in a state that has a reciprocal preference law. So, for example, Oregon, Washington, Idaho all are right now in an equal playing field. No bidders are disadvantaged generally because of residency. But they each have a reciprocal preference statute. So, again, if we enacted this bill, it would then set up a potential disadvantage for Oregon bidders going out to the states of Washington and Idaho to bid. We looked at California and Nevada and noted that same thing holds true. So virtually we are surrounded by neighbors who have, again, the reciprocal preference but have no general residential prohibition that would come into play. There are some other Oregon preferences currently in effect. They're listed in your packet, mainly, again, just for your information. And we've put the legal sites there. We currently have an in-state printing preference. We have a tie bid goes to the Oregon bidder preference. We have some subcontracting preferences for emerging small businesses in certain circumstances and for women, minority, and emerging small businesses in certain circumstances. Oftentimes, the Department of Transportation applies certain quotas and goals because of its federal funding. There is one last thing I'd like to speak to, I think, because you should be aware of it, and that is around the international effect. We went ahead and we did ask Department of Justice for some feedback on Senate Bill 546, and we know there will be other legislation coming in this session to talk about preferences. We thought it was wise to get their take on this, and Assistant Attorney General Keith Cutler gave us a very informal piece of advice, and again, this is in the testimony, explained that because the United States has signed a number of U.S. trade agreements and treaties with other countries, that we would want to be mindful to put into this statute potentially language that limits its applicability to circumstances where the preference would not be prohibited by a treaty to which the United States is a party. And this, of course, Legislative Council could assist you with. There is, I think, an interesting piece of information here around Canada. Canada has come into the discussion in recent months because of the license plate bids. And Mr. Cutler researched Canada for us. We found out that Canada has not signed on to what is called the sub-government agreement of the General Agreement on Trades, Tariffs and Trades. That's now the WTO. And we have. Now, what that means, per Mr. Cutler's advice, is that its provinces, because it hasn't signed a sub-government treaty, its provinces could potentially apply a preference to in-province bidders against out-of-province bidders. It doesn't mean that all Canadian provinces are doing that, and indeed some of them may, some of them may not be, but he just notes that. So potentially this fact leaves the door open for Oregon to apply a preference against Canadian provincial bidders. So I leave, I guess, this packet with you, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
So you have some issues with that. I noticed on subsection 3 or 3 in parentheses that the last paragraph, the BAS is not certain how Senate Bill 546 might interact with the other state preferences.
Well, Senator Nelson, we looked at, for example, the in-state printing preference, which again is a very one of great interest, I know, to some of the folks in Oregon. And each preference is written differently. Now, the in-state printing preference, for example, starts with the language that in-state printing will be done in-state. I mean, I'm sorry, that all printing will be done in-state. It doesn't actually set up a definite preference. It just says printing is to be done in-state. unless, and then it gives some conditions. One of the conditions is if there is not a reasonably competitive group of bids by in-state vendors, then the state printer may invite out-of-state bids. It doesn't actually set an actual amount of preference, but through tradition and at least one legal lawsuit that ended up in a legal opinion issued by the state Supreme Court, the state printer has traditionally used a 10% preference as kind of a guide. So because of the language of that in-state printing preference, we're not totally sure how that would apply with 546. If it would come first, I suspect it would, and then if 546 were enacted, how that would then come into play after the printing preference, or at all, again, we're not totally sure. So I think we wanted to make the committee aware of that, and there'd have to be some further research done with the final version of 546 in order to determine what the full impact would be.
Sounds good. We'll reopen the public hearing on this.
Any questions?
Well, I couldn't find my file, Mr. Chair, so I'll look for it later.
Ed?
Oh, thank you. Do you want to go first?
No, go ahead.
For the record, my name is Ed Glad. I'm with the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. Normally, the idea of preference for our group would be that local hire would be a preference that we would like to see implemented as contracts are let for construction work that's happening here in the state of Oregon. It makes a whole lot of sense that the capital that that the state is expending goes to the citizens of the state of Oregon, or as best as possible, and that the opportunity for that money to be circulated in the communities is very relevant for the sustaining of the Oregon economy. By extension, it makes sense that if the state of Oregon is going to be spending money in any of the agencies, contracting agencies, school districts, counties, cities, towns, whatever, are going to be expending money, that it makes sense to have some sort of effort to be able to make, you know, to give reasonable expectation that money will continue to stay in the state and circulate in the economy. Capital flight, I think, is something that is probably a trick of the trade that legislators need to keep an eye on as to how to make sure that our economy sustains itself the best as possible. In terms of this particular bill, I certainly support the concept of it. My dream would be is that you'd be encouraging companies to hire locally so much as a business principle. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Harris. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. My contractors are both public and private work contractors, but for the folks of mine that do public work, we appreciate the efforts of the sponsors of this legislation to do more to try and create work for Oregon companies. Construction industry, as you know, is the second hardest hit industry economically in the state right now, second only to manufacturing. And we understand that this bill is designed to try and create, where government spends money, economic opportunities for companies, including our own. Our concern is that this bill, while well-intentioned, has consequences for our companies that wouldn't serve us well. The reciprocal preferences, which Ms. Lancaster referenced, will have a significant impact on our companies. The Oregon Public Works environment is relatively small, especially in the highway department. And while we advocate strongly to increase that market and are eager to work with you to do that, very, very eager. despite all of that, even if we do, it is a relatively small market, and my contractors work all over the western states because there isn't a lot of work at home, and often bids come in within 1 or 2% of each other, and to apply a 5% preference against those bids would result in uncompetitive realities for those contractors. In addition, you look at the Portland-Vancouver marketplace. While we have a state line at the Columbia River, we don't have an economic line there. We have a region there that doesn't stock economically. And if we create in essence, a barrier there for folks that do work for the city of Vancouver and for Clark County and sell gravel, et cetera, it becomes a very difficult thing to have that preference applied against them. One of the things that the legislature can encourage public agencies to do to help contractors in Oregon is to ensure that when we do bid public work, that we do it in a way and in packages of a size that enable Oregon contractors to be competitive on those projects. We want to make sure that bids aren't so large that our own homegrown companies that have been here for a long time can't compete. Another thing for companies that have a specialized industry, i.e. license plates, you could create the same kind of scenario that is in effect for a printer's preference. For those that have a specific interest there, that is an opportunity, that is an option, but to apply a general preference puts at a disadvantage not only the construction companies that I represent, but other manufacturing companies and other supply companies that do business with the state that are based here in Oregon. Well, Oregon's residency requirements and how we defined an in-state resident, you know, perhaps you could set up shop for a year and call yourself an in-state bidder. We don't necessarily know what those requirements are going to be in each individual state. And our concern is that we could set up a system where Oregon companies who want to be competitive, not only in the western states but throughout the United States, could put themselves in a position where they can't be competitive. And in an economic environment, Oregon public works are not a large part of the United States public works marketplace. I don't think in this economic climate that we can afford to do that. Again, I very much appreciate the intentions of the sponsors. I think it was very well intentioned, and I can appreciate where they're coming from, because we do need to make sure that Oregon businesses have the best shot possible to acquire work that is put out by public agencies with public funds. But I think the best way to do that is put them in packages of a size that they can compete on and make sure that they're advertised and that every opportunity is made available for those companies to compete.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Jessica, I appreciate your comments. I was just wondering what Mr. Glad said. I'm just curious to your initial reaction to something about, since the idea is to make sure that Oregonians have jobs and work, and, you know, we don't get brick people taking jobs that we have capable people in the state to do. And Mr. Glad had commented, you know, he would prefer to have a preference for using Oregon workers on Oregon jobs as opposed to, you know, the corporate preference. Do you have any initial reaction to that? You know, if there was a preference for either, you know, using Oregon workers on, you know, when you work in our state, or a certain percentage of Oregon workers, that you have a preference for that, although you can be an out-of-state company and not be dinged in that regard, but we don't want you bringing your workers in and doing the project here as well. Do you have any initial reaction to something like that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, there were some amendments to several bills last session that dealt with enterprise zones and tax credits related to enterprise zones and projects under those that dealt with so-called local hire requirements. AGC was concerned at the time that those weren't so much local hire requirements as they were requirements that blurred the line between public works requirements on private construction jobs and public and private work. AGC, obviously, as homegrown companies, we would be willing to look at what local hire might look like. But the devil's always in the details. And so while I don't want to sound like we're close to the conversation, we're concerned. It depends on what that language looks like. But we're definitely willing to enter into a conversation on that.
Any questions? Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Harris, I appreciated your testimony, because unlike much of what I've heard lately, people come in and say they don't like the bill and they say all the bad things and they don't offer any alternatives, and it really gets frustrating sometimes. But you offered an alternative And I like what you're saying about packaging the contracts in smaller contracts so Oregon companies can bid on those. Because wouldn't you agree that I couldn't find my file upstairs, it's somewhere in that mess, but my recollection from talking about this in the interim is that when Oregon enacts a preference and another state doesn't have the same preference, then they'll just enact a statute or a law or some preference of their own that just keeps out an Oregon bidder. Isn't that generally what happens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, if they have the reciprocal preference, they can already smack us around. Or else they'll get busy in a hurry and adopt their own preference and keep us out. I think that we have to be very careful when we go down the preferences road. We do have opportunities to make public contracting in Oregon easier for Oregon companies. And quite frankly, Oregon's public contracting law needs some reform. And if I may take a moment and pitch a bill, there is a bill in the House side that is going, there's significant work is being done on that we hope to have over here for your consideration soon, House Bill 2341, that would rewrite Oregon's public contracting law and streamline many of these processes, making it much easier for Oregon's companies, especially small companies, to access the marketplace. And that's another way to reduce the red tape, create smaller packages where it's necessary, to make it possible for Oregon companies to access the marketplace. That is your best bet in making sure Oregon companies can compete not just here but elsewhere too, so that we can get more money flowing through Oregon's marketplace and get economic recovery underway.
Yeah, and if I might... I think of when Oregon passed a law, I think it was a law we passed that said that out-of-state residents were going to pay more at campgrounds and state parks than in-state residents, and it caused such an uproar among our neighboring states that we quickly retracted from that because then they turned around and said, well, then Oregon residents are going to pay more. So it is tit for tat, and it doesn't really seem to get us anywhere. But and I like Mr. Glad's idea about local hire. If that, and you're correct, the devil's in the details. But I think it's something that we should explore more thoroughly and see if we can add that to our package of good things that you want to do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, AGC is always willing to sit at the table and talk.
Yes, I understand that about you folks. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Tim and Mark, you want to testify? I think you were so important.
All right. Senator and members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. Been thinking through the testimony that preceded mine, and at this point I can only offer tentative and conditional support for the bill. I haven't yet had a chance to check in with our building trades affiliates. I've been trying to do that over the phone for the last hour successfully, so I can't speak for them, and I would like to be able to. So that's why I'm a little bit tentative still, having heard the prior testimony. Conditional because I actually think where we have greater potential here in terms of a Buy Oregon program would be to amend the subsequent statutes, 279.021, of the same section, which relate to the purchases of the purchase or lease of personal property, public improvements, or services. And actually, we think that's more to the point when we think of the experience we went through last year with the license plate manufacturer. And in that section, we already provide a 5% preference for recycled products. And it appears to us that when we're doing other forms of purchasing, we ought to be able to provide preference to resident manufacturers and providers of services. That was a concept we floated to some members of your committee. We had hoped this bill could be a vehicle for that kind of a preference. But we are talking about two slightly different aspects here, one public contracting, the other public purchasing. And so we'd ask you to kind of take another look at that. I'm not sure that we can give you this enlightened testimony of the kind you heard previously about what are the ramifications pro and con when you deal with the purchasing statute, but we would seriously like further consideration of what we can do under the rubric of Buy Oregon to advantage our economy, not to disadvantage any businesses, but to find a way that we can at least provide some reasonable advantage to resident businesses.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark Landair. I'm with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. I'd like to echo Ms. Harris's comments of Senator Metzger raising this issue. Certainly, the jobs and the economy are major issues, of course, confronting the legislature as well as the rest of the state. And certainly promoting more jobs in the state is a laudable goal, and we certainly support that. However, I would like to raise a couple of concerns that were previously mentioned by us previous testifiers here, and I won't go to and try to repeat them, but certainly we do have a concern about the reciprocal effects that other states would impose upon contractors making bids to other states, other public bodies. I'll take another tack at this as well. As a public body, we also have a responsibility to our taxpayers to provide quality jobs at the least, or excuse me, quality construction, shall I say, for the best possible price. And an example that I might use is a $15 million project where we received two bids, one from a firm in Vancouver, Washington, and one in Portland. The bidder in Vancouver could provide a bid that's $749,000 less than the company in Portland, yet we would have to issue the bid to the Portland company because they would have a 5% preference. I don't know if that's the wisest use of the taxpayers' money, and I'd just point that out. Another concern that we have is on the second page, specifically lines 38 and 39, that would require that a company have a residency in the state for 12 months. The concern there is, members, that new businesses that are just trying to get their feet wet, shall we say, in public contracting may very well be cut out of the process because they will be essentially penalized by other companies who have been in state longer than 12 months, because those companies that have been here for 12 months or more would get a 5% preference. That's really the conclusion of my testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Landauer, you hit on one of the points about why I have concerns about this bill, because the license plate issue, everybody jumped all over that. Oh, it was an Oregon company, it was an Oregon company. Well, gee whiz, that Oregon company had the contract for like 75 years or some darn thing. I can't find my notes right now, but they got outbid. They flat out got outbid by a company who could provide it at a better price to the state of Oregon, and we actually saved money. And they didn't have to shut their doors. They provided business to other people, and that information came out in the testimony. But that's my point. When you start implementing these preferences, it sounds really good at the outset to employ Oregon folks. It can have a nasty effect on the Oregon taxpayers and just on competitive business in the first instance. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yes, that's good.
Thank you. I appreciated Tim's comments about the recycling preference. I do see a potential recycled bill here. but I did want to make a few points on yours, just and I really appreciate this discussion, because I think we're all obviously trying to get to the same place, and that's refreshing. And hopefully this will spur some way in which we can make sure that we have growth. But just your one analogy, I had to challenge, because when you talk about a $15 million contract to a Portland company and it costs $750,000 more in taxes, that they'd be paying 9% state income tax, which is $1.3 million. There's a Portland business tax that you would get as a result of that. And you would also have those residents of Portland then paying income tax on a personal basis, which would far exceed the $750,000. So I just wanted to point that part out, which I think goes back to what Mr. Glad and the AGC representative Jessica also pointed out too, is that there is value to having the dollars recycled in our own community, because they do turn over and they provide other advantages. And this may very well it's one of those staffs that didn't quite work, and I certainly appreciate that. But I think there is value into maybe continuing to work to see how we make sure that we're not taken disadvantaged of. And as we look to grow things like our transportation infrastructure and others, that we make sure that Oregon workers and therefore Oregon companies have the best possible advantage without obviously disadvantaging ourselves in other states. And we certainly don't want to do that. So I thought this has been very interesting. I appreciate that. I think it gives us a better direction.
Respond to any of that?
Wilson and John, they need that portal money.
Yeah. I mean, the House Bill 2341, were you aware that that was out?
Yeah, I'm aware of that one. It's dealing with other issues, but it's the same general topic. Yeah.
Same general topic.
Yeah, so.
All right, well, very good. Any further questions of this panel? And we got a few issues to recycle. Is that the right word? Is that what you're... Okay, I've got no... Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 546, and unless there's further business, we will close the public hearing. Are we off?
How'd you do that math?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to know.
Well, no, I'm...